as a Chinese lover and as a martial arts expert and a magician like my son, and who has a beautiful expensive car with an unpronounceable name. So all of this has come out of the mind of Kerry Greenwood. We're very privileged to have her today to talk about this book. Most of you would know that in the 1880s, they published the most successful thriller in the history of the Western world, in the 19th century anyway, which was, of course, The Mystery of the Hansom Cab. It was set in St Kilda. And ever since then, St Kilda's been crawling with PIs, private investigators. In recent years, most of them have been female, I think. So it's a very long tradition. So thank you.
Hello, my name is Kerry Greenwood. It's nice to be here. I've always really liked St Kilda. And I think what I'm being brought here to talk about is why St Kilda makes an ideal place for my particular sort of book. So allow me to start with talking about Fanny Fisher, because the entire reason why St Kilda got into it is that it was the perfect place for her to be. So picture the scene. I am the eldest of four children, and it is my job in my mother's household. My father was a wharfie and worked shift work, so everybody had chores. My sister Amanda, for instance, used to wash the dishes, even when she had to stand on a stool to reach the sink. Crash, bang, sludge, first thing she bought when she was when she had her own household was a dishwasher. Anyway, she's never going to wash dishes again. Whereas I'm really so in love with telling stories, right? Elder sisters or elder persons or singles, yes? Yeah. Elder sisters or single children, lone children. Yeah. You'll know it's because we're very bossy. According to my sister Janet, I had a neurotic need for control greater than that of Joseph Stalin. But as all of my sisters here will agree, it's very hard to be an elder sister because you're expected to mind the little rat eggs, which is why I have no children. I will never have children. I have done my bit. But also, they don't mind you like they do your mother or your father. So consequently, you've got a continuous rebellion from the underclass. And you're going to be in awful trouble when your mother finds out that they have, for instance, painted the Labrador dog with blue shoe paint. How is it possible to remove? He just stayed blue until it wore off, or whatever, you know, dead snails to the baby. So consequently, keeping little toenails interested was the hardest thing to do. But I had to do it, or I didn't get away from my particular chore until it was getting late and I had other things to do, like almost anything else. Not that I like children. So what I used to do is we used to have a bath and we'd sort of bathe all the children, clean up the bathroom, make sure nobody got drowned, stuff everybody into their jammies, and then I had to tell a story. So I started off by reading stories. But unfortunately, the age range of my audience was from 3 years younger than me right down to 3 years old. And so consequently, anything that my little brother, who also had a lot of clout because he was the only boy, liked, everybody else was sick to death of. And that led to what my mother calls the hop-on-pop incident, when the book got thrown out the window, even though I have very strong liking for Dr. Seuss. I can see why, you know, to a 10-year-old it's going to be very boring, so I just started telling stories instead of reading them as a way of cutting down the internecine warfare and getting me back to what I wanted to do earlier, you know. And so I started telling stories, and anybody told stories to children, small children? Yes? They're a very strong-minded audience. If you read the story differently or tell the story differently, the next day you've got these little eyes looking at you saying, "You forgot the dragon." In a tone that indicates you have betrayed your country. "You forgot the dragon. Where's the dragon?" And, you know, after all. So it's much easier. That way I got really good at remembering what I did the night before. And instead of starting a new story every night, which is even for my sort of vagrant, grabbing you all the facts kind of mind a bit difficult, I used to tell stories in 10-minute intervals every night, which meant that I didn't have to make up a new story. And because I was telling fairy stories, their fairy stories are ideal for this purpose. How does a fairy story start? How does it end? In between, you can say anything you like. You're not bound by causality or reason or anything. And if you write yourself into a corner, which I used to frequently do, you can just say, and when they recovered from the spell, they were back on the road. They also have standard plots, which the small children haven't heard before. So they don't know that the, you know, that the story of the prince caught, you know, trapped in his tower, who needs to be rescued by a princess wearing stainless steel armour, riding a white horse. I had a mostly female audience. It's a new story. You know, they've never heard any of this stuff. So you do have advantages with small children. But anyway, so I told stories every night for years, and in these little 10-minute chunks. And if I always took one of the children as my protagonist, so which is a good way of keeping the noisiest little toenail quiet, because she knows I can always have him eaten by a dragon or locked up in a suitable dungeon with skeletons on the walls and dripping moisture and rats and all that sort of stuff. So, you know, a narrator's revenge may be long in coming, but it always comes in the end. So consequently, I told them that I didn't know that my family actually liked them at all. It was just I knew that they were keeping them quiet, which is all I wanted. And till a few Christmases ago, they lined up all my nephews and nieces in a little row. Everybody else had children, and said, Auntie Kerry's going to tell you the story about the dragon. I hope I remember the story. Anyway, it isn't difficult to spell children, except children are have acute bullshit detectors. They're very strong-minded on the subject of what they think the story ought to be, and if it isn't like that, they're going to tell you about it, at least. So they are quite an exigent audience, and that's always a useful thing. So I just kept telling stories, and when I started writing novels, because I love writing novels, and people are paying me for it, it's so nice of them, I wrote my first novel, a whole school holidays, sitting up in my mother's apricot tree, because I could fly and my siblings couldn't, and they couldn't see me, because people very seldom look up. And if they did see me, I had all these dead apricots to throw at them. And I could also see the whole garden, so I could interfere if they were doing something hideous. Like cutting up the hose into little pieces. Or walking the ridge pole of the roof, which my little brother did. Ooh. And he got down with one piece, you know. I wrote it a huge big, I had 100,000 words, it's all handwritten, and it took me a whole summer, and it's called The Magic Stone. My friend Jenny Powerbacker, who also is a children's book novelist, wrote almost an identical novel at the identical age and called it The Ruby of Zanzibar, but it's basically the same story. The first novel you write is always an imitation of your favourite author, which is why first novels are very seldom publishable. And this isn't, I mean, nobody's going to see it with me, but I've still got it. With the apricot stains on it. So I found that I just liked writing novels, so I kept writing novels. And because I also adored history, I tended to write historical novels. And I never actually thought of getting them published. I just was writing them for fun. There's great satisfaction in gathering up a story and watching it turn into a book. It's really a buzz. You know, the trouble is that now it's a lot harder. The work is a lot harder because I'm writing for everybody, not just for me. And so it's got to be more structured, and it's got to be more careful, and I've got to have my facts straight. Whereas in the old days, I used to just grab up whatever I felt like talking about and just whittle on with it. That was most amusing, but I never thought it would turn into a career, because I wanted to be a lawyer, because I wanted to work for what didn't exist at the time, legal aid. I wanted to help I come from Footscray, and we always knew there that no one is going to help us but ourselves. A Labor government doesn't help us because they're not going to vote anything else, and a Liberal government doesn't help us for precisely the same reason. So let's be anarchists steady, and there's no chance, really. Anyway, so having decided to do that, I did it. I was impressed. I think the first person from Marlborough High School ever to go to university. But then I kept writing novels just because they were company. In a novel, at least, I've got control more or less of the whole universe. And I was liking, before they were invented, I loved reversing gender roles. So, as they now call it. But basically, I liked the princess on her horse rescuing the prince, or whatever, because it was much more satisfying if you happen to be female. You know? So I just kept doing it, and finally I got the job I wanted after a lot of messing around, and I got to work for Legal Aid, which was what I really wanted to do, and which I'm still doing one day a week. And then I thought, I want to try and get published, so I because there were no writer's centres or any much information around at this time, I just set this novel, which was about the 1740s, highwayman in St Albans in England, around to all sorts of publishers who wouldn't publish that if they had, you know, rocks in their head. And I'd get it back and I'd think, right, okay, it's going out again. This is when we used to type. Remember typing?
Yeah.
So I'd have to, well, yes, I'd have to take off the front page, which had coffee rings on it, and retype it, and wipe out the rust around the staples, and also check out that it was still the piece of cat fur on page 87, indicating they hadn't opened it. And I just did it again, so I'm very stubborn and ambitious, but mostly very stubborn. So finally, luckily, I put a book into the Vogel Prize, which should be under 35 and have a first novel. Definitely worth doing. I didn't win it, which is good because the book I wrote wasn't very good. Hiram Fee, who was running a feminist publishing house in Brunswick Street, Fitzroy, with Guy Gribble, rang me up at Legal Aid and said, come and talk to us about a book. And my boss said, I went past him with a Durfler affection, I'm going to go see a publisher. I don't remember how I got to Brunswick Street, but anyway, I was there. She said, nice book, Jerry, we're not going to publish it. And I thought, that's true, I don't open the door, I'll just slide under it. Whoa, I thought, whoa. And at this point she said, I'll give you a 2-book contract for a detective story. And I said, yes. Nanoseconds before she finished the question, she changed her mind, you know. But then I got out, and there I was with a 2-book contract, and I said, I have to put it into 1928, because a historical concept, because I can't, at that time, I couldn't write about the present without getting myself tangled up in all kinds of ethical dilemmas about whether or not my clients were going to be in the book and stuff. So it was just too difficult. I've got over it now, but I couldn't do it at the time. And so that's another point. Never throw anything away. I had a story that I wrote at school, at the age of 14, that didn't work. It was a really good idea and it just didn't work. And so I stashed it. And every 10 years or so, I'd find it in my box of things that weren't finished. Interesting first chapters that never turned into novels. And I think, what's why that didn't work? And it still didn't work, and I put it away again. And at court about 2 years ago, I suddenly realized what was wrong with it. So written on the back of a legal aid form, this is what's wrong with this, not never write it. And it actually turned out to be a good story, and I sold it to an American collection. So never throw ideas away. All that was wrong with this idea is that I was looking at it from the wrong angle. I had the wrong narrator, and I couldn't work it out. But, you know, it went ping eventually, so things do go ping. Anyway, so 1928, when I was doing legal history with Dr. Ruth Campbell, a totally amazing woman, who was a professor of history at Melbourne University. She could trace around the thing. She had a very messy hair and all pinned up like this, and she kept losing hairpins. So when you saw a trail of hairpins, you could just follow it. And at the end of it, an amazing woman. So she's the one who said, never trust historians, especially me. And I thought, oh. So she taught me to do original research, which is probably some kind of addictive substance under the Poisons Act. Because once you start reading newspapers from another period, you get absolutely hooked. It's fascinating. I mean, I was supposed to be doing them. My father's divorcee. Everybody else was saying my grandfather's a judge. I didn't have a legal background at all. So I thought I can do the 1928 strike because it was comprehensive, it was fascinating, and there was a lot of nice repressive legislation, which the Fraser government was possibly replicating at the time. So I thought, I'll just make sure I can do this. And so it was sort of a legal thesis. But to do it, I had to read the newspapers. And I was sitting there in the Bayview Library, going blind because their rotten microfiche kept on going out of focus. You know, whoever was responsible for that microfiche is presently sitting in hell on a throne of burning coals, strapped down with the universe going in and out of focus. I fervently hope. Anyway, then I realised that you could shine your floors with shine oleum, that you could get perfectly good art silk stockings for 4 shillings and 11 pence with collops and segways, and so on. And after that, I was totally hooked on reading the gardening column and the ladies' column and all the stuff I was not supposed to be reading. I found and talked to all the old men I could find who were on the wharf in 1928, who were still around, because when you were 16, you were a man, and you got a man's wages. So there was Tom Hills, both of these are St Kilda persons. Tom Hills, known as Red Tom, And his brother was an extremely conservative New South, you do know him, yeah, New South Wales politician. And his best mate, Tibo Hayes, who was smaller than me, and, you know, a little thin guy who was, you see, a jockey. His grandfather was acquitted of treason in Rica, a Tipperary man, you know.
So I thought they were both on the wharf together, and they were mates.
And so instead of me asking them questions, I just read them bits from my research, you know, sort of the, and they'd say, oh, I remember that Black Jack Anderson. I'd say, who? Why would you call him Black Jack? But he'd have dark hair. He said it was his black heart. And once I stopped trying to interview them, this tapes were just full of me laughing and then telling me funny stories. But I got all the information I wanted, but also they started talking to each other about it, and they reverted. They lost a lot of their modern slang. They didn't have a lot of modern slang. They started talking running slang again, and I just soaked it all up because I was so fascinated. I was very generous with their time and their cups of tea. And and my father, luckily, also uses running slang, so he got onto the wharf when he came back from the shearing for 3 months, and he stayed there for 26 years. It's an interesting place, the waterfront. So consequently, when I was casting around for a time that I thought I knew enough about to set a detective story in, I thought 1928, I know a lot about 1928, but they've never thrown away any of my research because it was such a lot of work. I mean, I got a gold star and elephant stamp from Professor Campbell, and then I just put it all away. But unfortunately, of course, I didn't know anything like enough about it to write a novel, because to write a novel, you've really got to have 10 times the information that you use. Otherwise, you'll end up writing the sort of thing that I remember, a novel called for children called Verity of Sydney Town. Anybody who read it is probably still wincing. You know, where you see Verity, said Verity, stepping down two steps into the street. They go to Joseph Banks, 15 page thing about Joseph Banks, and he's talking too. Too much information. But I've got to know it, or otherwise I'm not going to be able to convey it. And you've got to trust me. You've got to trust the historical novelist to know what they're talking about. So I got on the tram with my two-book contract fixed in my fingers. And so I need a historical detective story, and I'm going to have a female protagonist, because that was always the fun way of writing it, because I was panicking about writing a detective story, because I'd read lots of them, but I'd never tried to write one. When, clenched, see, the fist is still clenched. And
I never tried to write one, so I thought, now, damn it, instead of worrying about that, I'll do the way I've written novels. Well, I've written about at least eight or nine novels that could be considered to be, you know, novels, real novels, by then. So I thought, I know what happened. How do I write a novel? I find out who's the main character, and the main character tells me the story. This is not a sensible way of writing novels, but you write from where you dream, not from where you think. All that the novel wants of you is, it wants to be told, it's a story, it wants to be told. All it needs is your ability to, you know, type and grammar and, you know, things like that. This is the way I've written now 49 published novels, and several other things, an awful lot of other stuff, and three novels on ancient Greece, and that's the way I did it. Now that was weird, because I already knew what was going to happen in the ancient Greek books, whereas I didn't know what was going to happen in the Thrawny books. In fact, I was fairly sure nothing was going to happen. But anyway, I got on the tram, clack-clack down Brunswick Street, clack-clack on the way home to Footscray, and thought, I need a main character. Who is she going to be? This was when the only persons writing female detective stories in Australia were me and Jennifer Rowe. And so it was the beginning. This is 1988. It was the beginning of the whole Floriac thing, but it wasn't Floriacing yet. So I thought, yeah, all right. I'm trying to think of a name, and I had, for some reason, been looking up 1900 birth notices. I've forgotten why. And there were also a lot of Greek names, or what the English fondly think of Greek names. And there was some raw work at the font, I tell you. All little things. Adrastus. Xerxes. It's a weird thing to do to a child, it really is. Anyway, I thought, all right, I'm an honorary Greek from early childhood. My best friend at school was the National Church Thessalopoulos, and who was in the fourth grade before she could write her name in English. And she became a primary teacher. And she said, after the first day of the children saying, good morning, Miss Georgia Vassilopoulos. She changed her name to George. I later married a guy called Gardner, so it's sort of simplified. Anyway, I also have some, you know, basic grounding in Greek, and I love Greek legends. So, and stories and stuff. And so I thought, breakdance. Okay, well, there's Iris, there's Iris, Miss the Rainbow. Nice and pretty, but, you know, yeah. Psyche was a perfectly polite girl until she summoned up with Eros and poured oil on him and had to chase him over half the world. That's not quite what I had in mind. I wanted an adventuress. I wanted someone like the Saint. Did anyone ever read Leslie Charteris?
Yeah.
I collected armloads of these books from the off shop when I was a child because we couldn't afford new books, which is why I get such a kick out of buying them now. And so I wanted someone like the Saint, but with, you know, less prone to shoot people and not an actual criminal. But that was the sort of, that was a 20s hero, you know. I would have loved to. I wrote my friend David a John Buchan novel for his birthday once, but I didn't think I could get away with nicking John Buchan's characters, even though they were very much fun to write about. So I thought, all right, Psyche, Irene is the way that they said it, but which is kind of close to Elena, but she's the goddess of peace. And have you ever known an Irene that wasn't dead stroppy? I put it to you. Something about being called the goddess of peace that really does things for her. So, but then I thought, Phryne, aha, which is actually ancient Greek for little toad. I think you would pronounce it in ancient Greek, Phryne, but it's Phryne in the same way as Psyche and Irene and Iris. The longings are what the English book produced, the Greek pronunciation, bless their hearts. And it's perfectly all right with me. So Phryne was the historical Phryne, was a courtesan, a hetera. Not a prostitute, a woman who takes lovers and then when they run out of money she takes another lover. So beautiful that she was Apollo's model for Aphrodite. The Aphrodite said, she's gorgeous. Admittedly she's been lifted up out of the water by two attendants and looks like she's wearing a wet t-shirt. But she is gorgeous. She was, and also because I was a genie solicitor, and I still am, a genie solicitor is someone who goes to the magistrate's court. Anybody who's got problems, it's my problem until I can fix it, or flick it, or adjourn it, or whatever, you know. So I'm very used to emergency thinking, my mother calls it. And Phryne, the historical Phryne, was charged with entering the sea during the Eleusinian Mysteries, which is heresy or blasphemy. So sometimes she gets stoned to death anyway. And here there is an audience, all male of course, of the wealthy persons of I think it was Thebes. They deserve their ruins. And there is she's not allowed to speak, of course, but being female, but her advocate is in the same position as I've often been, which is you start off with, it wasn't us and we weren't there. And if it was us, and we were there, we didn't do it. And if it was us and we were there and we did it, we didn't mean it. And if it was us and we were there and we did it, we're sorry. And none of that had worked. And boy, have I been through that one a lot. So he did something that I would absolutely adore to do in Sunshine Magistrate's Court. He reached over to Phryne and pulled off her garment, which was a chiton held on by two brooches, grip, leaving her standing naked and gorgeous in front of this jury, and produced the classic ancient Greek argument. Could anyone this beautiful have done anything? And they all seem to quit her instantly and we want to phone them, like, you know. And as I said, I'd love to try it in Sunshine, but the magistrate wouldn't appreciate it perhaps, and clients are so much harder to undress. You can't do it with one of those, you know, rib things. And it just wouldn't work. Anyway, so I thought, right, Phryne, very rich. She offered to reveal the walls of Thebes, provided that she could put a sign on it saying, the walls of Thebes ruined by time, rebuilt by Phryne the Hetera. And they kept the ruins. And she retired full of years and bad works into Corinth and became a citizen. So, amazing woman. So I said, Phryne, what a lovely name. I like that, Phryne. I only ever thought I'd ever write two novels, so I never thought that I'd be lining myself for a last one saying, it's Phryne rhymes with Briny. And so as in physician, it's all my own fault. Yeah, I just wasn't thinking ahead. I was sort of panicking a lot at the time. So then I thought I'll give her a loaded second name because I'm going to get into awful trouble with the cognoscenti and the literati for writing a detective story because although that has now become respectable, it wasn't respectable at the time. And I still, when I did two or three books, I still had people coming up and patting me on the shoulder and saying, why don't you write a real book? You're really quite good. And I thought, next time he says that he's going to get such a clip over the ears. So I thought, better I should produce a preemptive rape The theory of a preemptive rape is belongs to the cartoonist called Patrick Cook, where if somebody's going to come up to you and you know they're going to come up to you and say something you're going to have to object to, the thing is to pin them to the wall first with a preemptive rape on something completely ridiculous. So, for instance, when you've got someone who's saying, when, for instance, I still smoke cigarettes, and so someone is sure to come up to me sooner or later and say, don't you realise you're ruining your lungs? Of course I realise I'm ruining my lungs. And so what I don't need, what I need to stop someone like that in their tracks is to say, don't you realise the genetic evils of chicken stock cubes? And they go all strange and go away, you know. So I thought I need something to do, so I call her Fisher, because that's one thing I am partly Welsh, and I can do Grail legends until whole herds of cows come home. And of course the name of the Sinner King, Roy Peshoner, is also the Fisher King. Plus, of course, a friend of mine had just come back from Paris and told me that in the 20s, the place to learn the tango, if you're a female and you wanted to dance with a gigolo who could dance, you needed to be at the Rue de la Chatte qui Pêche, the Street of the Fishing Cat, which is still there. It's a tiny little narrow thing going down from, in the Quartier Latin, going down near Notre Dame. So I thought, all right, Fisher is good. I like it. Also, you could say that detectives are fishers of men in a fashionable sense, which should annoy any Christians, or, you know, fundamentalist Christian. And, I like it. So she was funny Fisher by the time I got off the tram and caught the train home. And after that, I had no control over it whatsoever. But I thought, I will at least, as you do with a fairy story, I'll endow her with the very best of everything I can think of. I'll give her a title, an English title, only a minor one. Her father's only a baron, but it'll mean you know, that her shoes will be continuously wet from the, as cognoscenti in Australia, licking them. So she's beyond Fanny Fisher. She's not even Lady Fanny Fisher, but she's beyond. I give her lots of money so she can do exactly what she wants. And to start with, she was staying at the Windsor. This is in the first book, Cloaks and Blues, because that was the best hotel in Melbourne at the time. It's still a pretty good one. Go there for their afternoon tea. But don't eat for some days beforehand. Anyway, so Fanny got to Melbourne and I started doing the straight research, which is all the stuff I didn't know. Like, you know, which ships were coming in when and where they landed and what the whole, you know, all that sort of stuff. And so that was all State Library. There's a massive amount of information in the State Library. And if you go in and ask nicely, they just landed on your phone. And when you fight your way to the surface, you really know a lot more about it. A thing that's absolutely essential if you want to do any historical writing is you must find a map. If you haven't got a map of the city changes quite a lot. When I was trying to write about Sydney, the city had changed so much that I actually had to, and there was so little information about it, that I actually had to, I could do Glebe, I could do the university, I could do this bit of the city. I actually was confident about that. And I actually had it on the day when they were bringing the bells in to put up in the campanile in the university. But the rest of it was too impossible, it was impossible for me to find out all the rest of the information from Melbourne. And although I like Sydney, I don't like staying there much. And the information I had was, you know, somebody had fortunately decided to go up to the top of the Hotel Australia in 1928 and take a photograph from each direction. It was so nice of them. because that way it showed me that the bridge was still about that far apart. It still wasn't fixed. It must have been, actually you can get a better idea of it by, there's a painting. I think it's Rose Lindsay. Of the unfinished, as Cousin Smith, you're right, yeah, of the unfinished bridge gives you a better idea of what it actually felt like or looked like. But anyway, fortunately, however, I live in Melbourne. So I did a lot of the basic Melbourne research for the first book. At one point, my friend David Stalwart, an amazing person that he is, he said, you know, if that research gets pile of, you know, books and photocopies and stuff gets any higher, it'll undergo gravitational attraction and form a black hole, which is where he was convinced his keys had always gone. You know, wallets, other important bits of information. So I really did a massive amount of it for the first book. But meanwhile, the story was just going lollop, 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 you know, and I just had to keep up with it. So I thought, all right, I really like writing these sort of novels. But to do it, you've got to know what you're talking about, and I've got to be sure. So I had, there are maps and there are directories of the city, which are also capable of giving you a smile, because the directory tells you not only you know, it doesn't only have maps of the streets and things, it tells you who lived in each house, how many people lived there, what their profession was. So I was looking up Little Lonsdale Street, a place of notorious naughtiness, and it was full of confectioners, Miss Jones, confectioner, Miss Smith, confectioner, Madame Dufarge, French confectioner. And interestingly enough, at Madame's house, they were doing it, they did an archaeological dig, which I went along for a little light digging. And I was at Madame's house, these tiny little houses with tiny little gardens. This is when the city wasn't sewered, so there was a privy at the back, and the nightmen used to come and down those narrow little alleys. And so Madame's house is here. There was in most houses, although all the rest of the ones you looked at, there was a stratum of beer bottles, several strata of beer bottles, and domestic chunks, you know, sort of corn-based tins, and gingerbread bottles with those little things, with them. They were cute. My father used to smash them when he was a child and take out the little round alleys to use as marbles. He sort of now wishes he kind of kept the bottles, but it's a bit late. Anyway, then in Madame's back garden, there was strata of oyster shells, champagne bottles, oyster shells. I thought, the French confection, it's more expensive. Horseshoe. Anyway, so when I was casting out where is Franny going to live, because it looks like I wrote the first two books, and then I had another contract for the next book, and another contract, and I thought, all right, we're going to get a house. So where around the 1928 city of Melbourne would someone like Franny be comfortable? It's no use her living in the city. She can't stay living in the city. Very few people actually lived in the city in the 20s anyway. And she's not likely to move out west because that was all industry out where I live, which isn't now, but it was all industry. You know, there's that feeling of being separated, footgrain over that way, is sort of an island where you go, there's either railway yards or there is the extreme fog of the flats. It's just, you know, that's not the right way. Much as I consider that, you know, my particular part of the world is a really good part of the world. So I thought, maybe a tourist, Carlton is a little too raffish, St Kilda, perfect. So I came down for walkies, and because this was our big treat when I was a child, we used to go on the train to St Kilda, we used to go to Luna Park, and we used to walk down Ackland Street and buy one cake. They were always fantastic. Ah, those cakes. Particularly, I remember, we got very few cakes at the time. We were very broke, so one, my siblings tended to go for cream cakes, which had cream and sort of, you know, thinly enclosed with a little bit of pastry. But I liked those really dense, dark chocolatey cakes like, what's it called, Schwarztorster, and all those other, you know, really, they lasted for ages. They lasted all the way around on the train. Anyway, but I didn't actually know much about St Kilda, so I had to walk around. And then I was very fortunate to find out that Kay Rowan, who may still be, Kay Rowan, the astounding Kay Rowan, you know, and you just go here, ask him nicely, smile sweetly. In my case, I could kiss her feet. She probably wouldn't find that very embarrassing. A very modest woman knows absolutely everything there is to know about where all the information is about St Kilda. And I have been, I made such a pig of myself in the St Kilda archives that I actually wrote two books from one couple of days' research. Because I was researching it in Montparnasse, this one, which some of it's in Montparnasse in Paris, but a lot of it's in St Kilda. And so I wanted a street map. I wanted to work out where a French restaurant would have been. I wanted to work out if there was a French restaurant I could use, which there wasn't that. And, you know, all the other things to know, I needed to know about it. So there was even a beautiful photograph. There's an excellent archive of photographs of the Catani Gardens on what looks like a picnic day. They haven't specifically said what day it was, but it's absolutely stuffed with people. All of them are wearing 1920s clothes and are looking exactly like a present audience. Shabby. And they're eating sandwiches, and there's always one little boy going, "Hi, Mum!" at the camera. There's wonderful photos. There's all the newspapers. In the 20s, St Kilda had three newspapers, and you could even cross-reference them to find them out. So I found out so much about... This was about the Lord Mayor's Ball, was what I wanted to know about. It's not a dance, it's a raffle. Some of those Lord Mayors were not estimable persons. And so I found out all about the Lord Mayor's Ball, but I also found out so much about the very first St Kilda Festival, which was called a flower parade, which is a whole week of fascinating activities like life-saving and brass bands and lantern shows and marching people and all kinds of stuff. It was fascinating. They were even complaining about the cost of putting the fairy lights up for the show. And she had all of the mayoral debates, the minutes, from the St Kilda Council. So, yeah, they were all there. So I just made copies of a whole lot of stuff, and I found that I had enough. I couldn't put in the it was too much to put in one book. I could only put one or the other. So this one turned out to be the Lord Mayor's Ball, which was very successful, and I had a very good description of it. And it's a pity some of the town hall burned down before I saw a few things happen. And then for the flower parade, it ended up the Queen of the Flowers, and that's the ultimate, the last scene of that is the parade, and all of it's happening for the whole week. So if you want local, if you want to do anything, research anything specific, Kay Rowan is your woman. Bring her apes, ivory, peacocks, or a bunch of flowers, or a box of chocolate. But she really does know anything, and she is immensely helpful. She goes totally out of her way to find things, and, you know, must be by that stage digging down deep into the silt to try and lay her hands on things. What time is it? All right. Now, what would you like me to talk about? I'm interested. I'll have you answer questions.
I wonder, when I'm driving along Beach Road, it's probably not called Beach Road, which house she would have lived in.
Yeah, that was the thing. I had hours of fun finding it. Actually, the house I wanted isn't in the street. It's just around the corner, in just in the bit of the street that goes up to Fitzroy Street. It's a white standalone.
Yeah,
that one. That's
where
the one.
Off Fitzroy Street and look.
Yeah.
In there.
Yeah. It's the White House. It's gorgeous, and it was just exactly. I know that unfortunately, Beach Road was quite extensively, you know, renovated, pulled down, etc., etc. So the house that would have been around that number looked like that. So I can at least say it looked like that. Yeah. Talk to me.
Probably just from why it changed when you were writing for yourself, and you didn't need to worry about the facts and things.
Well, I did need to worry about the facts, but I didn't need to worry about pleasing the editor, which is a different kettle of thingy altogether. And if there's a certain, I'm trying to find an analogy, and I can't think of one. There's a certain sort of privacy in writing a novel. It's just you and the book, and your bosom buddies, and you sort of walk together, sleep together. You're totally connected with it as long as it takes to write it. But I suppose it's a bit like childbirth, though. Of course, as I said, I didn't do that. Where suddenly you find it's a baby and it's got its own personality and its own way of doing things and it doesn't care if you're tired, and then you have to send it to school and you've got to give it to someone else, and that's really not a nice feeling. It's I wouldn't do it except if I need the money. If you want to write to yourself, because I'm still writing for myself, I'm writing the sort of book Friday wants me to write. She tells me the story. I hear the Hispano trees at the end of my street going vroom vroom, and I think, oh goody. Comes back, pushes on the table, lights gasp, and starts telling me a story. I just have to type fast enough to keep up. I dream it. I live in it. At the moment, I'm giving myself a serious case of multiple headaches because Franny's just about, she's at Queenscliff at the moment. I'm at chapter 8 of a new book. And she's going to go visit the Surrealists next door, so I was reading. She's going to see an art movie, and I've just been reading Surrealism. It rots the brain, I tell you what. They're looking at the world at right angles to reality. It's very difficult, and so the Surrealists and I are, you know, never going to be like this. But then again, I don't think they were like that to anyone. Da da. It isn't helped by the fact that it was some of my favourite poets were Surrealists. And they wrote incredibly clear, you know, like Rambo. Very, very clear, very simple verse, you know, very easy. Until you try to start trying to translate it when you find it's not in the least simple. But, anyway, that's what I'm doing at the moment. So at the moment I'm not exactly terribly sane, but I'll be back. But there is a difference. If you write to yourself, you write exactly like what you want to write. And you know you won't be misunderstood because you're reading it. But if you write it to someone else, you get, I've had manuscripts back that had yellow stickies all over them. And this is in the days of typing when you had to cut the manuscript up, write a new bit and stick it on. My first couple of manuscripts were just great. And a sort of collage of things where you get an editor who says, did they have writing on the 20 carat? And wanting to call me on every single fact means I get more careful when I'm writing, so I don't have to say, yes, they did have writing. Funnily enough, there were, I think, 7 stations on the radio. They're at the bottom of the newspaper. You can read them. And they even started doing radio serials. Who knows what evil lurks in the heart of men? The shadow knows.
Do you ever have your characters do something that you didn't really want them to do, but they insist on doing it?
Frequently, yeah. I don't insist anymore. On the third, I thought when I got to the third book, this was the Murder on the Ballarat Train. I thought, all right, this time I'll write it properly. I won't do it in this totally insane way, which is to start writing and not stop till I'm running the book. This is mad. You know, it's not what they told you at school. They told you to have a plan and a plot and all that stuff. So I'll try, I'll do that. So I wrote a plan, I wrote a plot, and Tony said, sorry, dear, I'm busy. I'm going skiing, and off she went. And I just sat there, and this place I used to type. So I'm sitting going, I type letters to everybody I've met since primary school. You know, lots of people were astonished to get letters, because they used to say, if you get stuck, start writing a letter to someone. So I wrote a letter. I wrote diary entries that's 700 pages long. And I sat there typing, you know, E-E-E-A-E-E-E, and nothing worked. So I said, okay, fine, I'm tearing up, I'm throwing it away, tear, tear, throw, throw. After about a couple of days, she came back and I thought, you're not going to do that again, are you? And I thought, I'm not. So, yeah, if one character takes off on you, go with the character, that's the one who's got the story that wants to be told. And there are plenty of people who will teach you to write by, because writer classes have to do something to justify justify their fees. I never went to writing class and I couldn't stand it because I hate anybody seeing anything before it's finished. It's a nice Greek proverb that my dear deceased friend used to say. But I think actually it's not Greek, it's French. Only fools and the uneducated criticise the word half done. And that's what happens all the time in writing classes, and I couldn't stand it. My ego would have been flayed to pieces and jumped up and down on, and I would have gone away crying. I do not have a bold nature when it comes to writing. Everything else, yes, but writing, no. So if your character is going chadum 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 and your minor character is turning into a major character, go with that character. They've got the strongest story. They want you to tell it. I had a friend who was writing a book he never finished, damn it. It was really interesting about Middle Ages France. And he said, I said, what happened to her? You gave me the first chapter, it was really good. And I said, more, write more, which is the only acceptable thing. If somebody gives you the first chapter of a book and says, what do you think? All you are really allowed to say is, fantastic, keep writing. So scratching someone at that stage of their development is just cruel. And, you know, it really is wicked. You mustn't do it. And anyway, the other useful thing is, I can tell you, this is a free hint. Do not ever stop at the end of chapter one and try and make it perfect, because you can't. It's a catch-22. You can't do it. Even I, who can write a book, I once wrote one of those books in 13 days. Didn't sleep a lot, but, you know. I did finish the book in 13 days. 75,000 words, my fingers really fell off. We'll have to go back and rewrite chapter one, because by the time you get to the end of the book, it's no longer what you thought it was going to be when you started. So if I can, if 13 days, that's the fastest anyone can write a novel in terms of, you know, of starting from scratch and finishing it and having it make sense, and some of the words are different. You have to go back and change chapter one. You have to fit it to the first, to the book, to the rest of the book. You just have to. It's one of those things. Everyone does it. So do not ever decide that, or do not come up to me at the Writers' Festival, catch me by the street and say, I'm going to have a really good book once I get chapter one right. Because you can't get chapter one right. What you'll have is 85 versions of chapter one. Don't do it. You know, your executives are going to hate you.
Mm. And you've got a whole 1928 world in mind. Do you have a
It's
like,
there's
a flavour.
Mm.
Would you say it's the
20s
or is it
20? No, it's 20s. It really is. A lot of people who are around in the 20s have said, oh yes, it's just what it was like, which is nice of them. But the 20s were very like the 70s. They were revolutionary, hungry, brittle, strange, nervous. And funnily enough, you know, after we've gone over the 70s, you know, lots of free love, free beers, sort of Dylan Thomas said. Suddenly we've got a Great Depression turning up, which is interesting. But it was the generation obliterated in the First World War. Women had suddenly found out they were powerful because they had to do all the stuff that men would otherwise have done. They couldn't be stopped from doing it because someone had to shovel the coal. You know, someone had to do all the stuff that women were doing. Suddenly found out that they were strong. Even though most of them had known that, but most of them hadn't known they were that good at, as it might be. You know, all the things that they said women couldn't do. I mean, anyone who's hauled around a 45-pound child all day will laugh merrily when they say women are weak. Especially if the little rat that goes to sleep where it weighs about 400 pounds compresses the shoulder. And it's nice when it goes to sleep. There's a fizzy kind of taste to the 20s. More like something like gin and ginger beer, whereas the 70s tasted much more like goat smoke. What's the name of that stuff we used to drink? Bundaberg rum. Oh. And Coke. But basically, yes, I could sum it up in tastes and things like that. And I got a feeling for it. I'm just moving, this book's just moved into January 29th, when he's gone on holiday. And the big crunch of the Depression didn't really hit Australia until 1931, 32. But it's thank you. I hope that I have a feeling. But I always start writing a funny book. I do find myself being plunged, bud. Oh, we're back in 1928. I can do that, I think. Yes.
My question is a continuation of that. And what about specifically St Kilda? What would have been like living in St Kilda in that?
It would have been good, except a bit nervous on Saturday night, and Navy night. The thing to remember about the 20s is that crime has been going down since 1960. Street crime was much higher in the 20s, so you would not have made it if you were the Irish test, you know. What is it, a virgin carrying a baby in one arm and a cock of gold in the other? Would have made it to the tram, possibly. But only if she gets the baby or the gold, you know. Street crime was much higher. There were very few, policemen were very, well, there were plenty of them around, but they were not exactly, you know, heavily mobile. There was only one radio car and it was in the city. So stuff tended to get solved and people lived in villages. And St Kilda itself was a subdivision, but there were two or three villages in St Kilda. And there was a big flooding population because there was the background of it being a respectable watering place for, you know, like Brighton. Mm-hmm. But also like Brighton, it had a flooding population of surface people, sailors, gypsies, passers through, traders, and especially during the start of Depression, had people selling things door to door and men walking to try and get a job on the ships. And so that gave it much more cosmopolitan edge. It had a lot more, I think it had the three Italian restaurants, cafes. There was also the 6 o'clock school, which meant that you couldn't buy a drink after 6 o'clock, but there was nothing to stop you buying a crate and taking it home, you know, or to a party. So people were much less likely to be in establishments and much more likely to be on the street, on the beach, or at someone's house getting thoroughly polluted and starting to fight. There was also much less tolerance. There was much greater tolerance of men hitting each other, which they did a lot. And such as, you know, even Elton John said that, Saturday night's all right surviving. There was a beautiful article by Lenny Lower. The trouble with parties is there aren't enough fights. it really was a violent society, but it was also something like a dueling society in that there was none of this trigger temper stuff except the deranged. So there were various steps up to whether or not I'm going to hit you, which could easily, and it's 4 or 5 points, somebody could, you know, gracefully withdraw. By God, sir. I accept your apology, you know. Very much like human societies, the more violent a society is, I've noticed, the more ways there are at getting out of actually stabbing someone. But it was much more violent, but this was one of the few places that was really cosmopolitan. Because of we had the Jewish population, because the first people came out from Russia, and so there was always an extensive Jewish population, which produces very good bread and excellent things and very quiet streets on Saturdays. Plus, some bits of it were quiet. Then there was a continuous number of a considerable number of ladies of exceptionally negotiable attention who would have been. I actually had Franny walking down Fitzroy Street, which was very notoriously notorious. I mean, even more notorious than other bits. Walking down Fitzroy Street towards the sea, on a hot night, and because St Kilda was also known, it got very late, but it always smelled of seawater because they used to wash the streets with seawater. So they still do that. I know it's a good idea, actually. So it always smelled salty. That's what they say, contemporaries say. So as she's coming down the street on a hot night with the wind, north wind blowing, so it's dusty and hot and smells like dried seaweed because of the water that they used to wash the streets. So there'd be drunks, there'd be sailors, there'd be prostitutes. In fact, she gets challenged by someone. Excuse me, this is my patch. And yet there are also the Salvation Army, God bless their hearts, who are coming to fetch people up off. They had a wheeled stretcher. I have a very good description. I think it's a photograph of it. They used to use to pick up the deeply inebriated or possibly dead off out of the gutter. This is true, yes, you remember?
Oh, you wouldn't remember. You're old enough to remember it.
The salvos with, you know, in full salvo uniform, blue, red cap and everything, would be piling up bodies onto their stretcher to take them to the police station, whereas next to the police station there was a sort of drunks room which was full of straw, where you just lay out the drunks and let them go. It was equivalent to being, in fact, he killed a boasted. They didn't have as many drunks as anyone else because they never charged them. They just used to bung them in the drunk room and leave them, let them out when they were sober, so that meant that they never had any people charged with drunkenness. So it was, and of course there's always the carnies, there's always fairy floss, which is turkey lolly in the 20s, fairy floss, sponge sugar, yeah, frightful fish and chips, cooked in something that resembled, somebody said, industrial oil, and still in the 20s, not many, there's still men and horses and horse-drawn drags, and there's still a reasonable trade with the fishing fleet, so you would have been able to get very good fish in Sequoia, so it would have been fascinating, you know. Occasionally, I mean, once in my life, I was walking up and down the main street of Hamilton to try and find out where the circus stopped, because I had two statements about where the circus stopped. One was down by the railway yards and one was down by the river, and neither of them agreed. So I started a fight in every pub in Hamilton. I figured that anybody who's sitting around at 11 o'clock in the morning in the pub is probably not going to look to occupy their day. And so I just went asked the question, and I started these terrible arguments in these pubs. It was still on when I was a little kid. All right. So eventually I put them down by the railways because that was it was about 60% or something. But I had, I was walking down, Hamilton is more or less in one piece, the main street. It's been renovated, but if you want to see, if you're looking around the city, look up. If you look above the first floor, you'll see amazing things. Even in Melbourne now, you're still a bit young. Across the road from Myers, if you look up, you'll see that there's still halls. Absolutely. And if you go a bit further up, do not miss the Caledonian Insurance Company's white things. It's got gargoyles and all sorts of stuff on it. Fascinating. I was walking along, and this is about 1 o'clock, and I've been there for a couple of hours. Scary, not to say scary, but I was intriguing people, and they're country people, so they're so polite.
they didn't want to ask me what I was doing. And I had a clipboard, you know, of course, with things on it initially making notes. And they were really interested by the time I'd been doing this for 2 hours. And I hadn't stopped anybody and asked them if I was saved or anything, so I didn't know what I was doing. So I actually got to a point where there was a hazard shop, and the hazard is a bow window with a, and it had some, well, I hadn't changed much in the country, had a leather hat and a couple of other hats like that, and I looked at them, and just for a minute, I could see the sepia, as though it was a sepia photograph, exactly what it looked like in 1928. And then this lady with the baby in the stroller ran into me, and by the time I got ourselves untangled, it had gone, but I did see it for a minute. Then I borrowed a sewing minutes later to find out how high, what you could see from, if you could see the pictures, the picture here, which is now an emporium for junk, but was a cinema, from the top of an elephant stack. So I need to go up 15 feet, so he let me slide up. And I thought, you could see it, good, because the end of this, I just got near the end of this book and that's what it was going to be about, I thought. Anyway, and it turned out it was, but bloody circuses. So when I got down, the man said, hey, what are you doing? And I said, I'm just teaching people. He said, oh, sorry. They thought I was a travelling missionary for something totally frightful.
Do you think crime is going to age more?
Not in this. I did age her for just to find out what she'd be like. In Blood and Circuses, that was my 8th novel. I thought, I've got to take away everything she's, all her beautiful things, her position. And in the case of Blood Circuses, I thought, if I'm going to keep writing this, each one of these books has to be different. Because if I'm just writing the same thing, it was good for Agatha Christie, but not me. I get bored, and if I get bored with what I'm writing, it will really be crap. So I took away her position, her title, her money. I made her fall off a horse twice a day, which I did. I learned to stand up on a horse myself, and the pain is intense. You don't hit the ground, but you've got a governor on. But it digs into all the important bits as you swing and don't actually hit the ground. You know, the bruises are remarkable. And so then I took away her nice clothes, her nice, I made her eat mutton stew every day, and in the end she came up a goddess, so I said, okay, we're stuck with this, we're stuck with each other, you know, we're still happy. But in pursuit of that, there was, I think it was Stuart, I can't remember who did it, there was a collection of things called True Detectives, where writers of fictional detectives were asked to get their detective to solve a real crime. And when which was really fun, because my dad was in Adelaide when my father was in Adelaide with a boxing troupe. There was a very strange death or murder, possibly a murder, which happened on Somerton Beach, which if you've been to Adelaide, you know, it's really not what place you'd expect a murder. It's terribly respectable, and it's really, really sort of, you know, nice, surrounded by houses and trees and things. And this man was found sitting on the bottom step, you have to walk down to the sea, perfectly dead, without any particular reason, well, no mark on him, no sign of poison, no sign of anything, just dead. He was, in fact, died of death, ceased to function. And no, all of the labels and everything he was wearing had been cut out, even the label in his hat had been removed, and that he was completely, absolutely, no label in his handkerchief, no washing marks. And apart from that, my father, who was rather sharp dressed in those days, suggested he was probably wearing an American suit rather than an English one, because of the narrow lapels. And he was very good looking, and he was about 45, and he was dead. So nobody ever found out who he was, or why he was there, or what happened. And that was 1945. So I thought, okay, I'll age Friday to 45, and she can solve it. Which, of course, she did, with amazing style. But she, apart from that, she didn't like Dior's new look, which is completely wrong for a small, thin woman. You ought to look like your... Sort of my mother would say, I look like an umbrella. But apart from that, she didn't like Dior. She'd been in the French Resistance during the Second World War, of course, and she turned naturally. And her black hair's got white streaks. My sister Janet has black hair like that, and she's got white streaks now. And, so she can age. She will be astounding whatever age she is. She's a hero. And Corinna Chapman, my baker, is a real person who makes mistakes. She's a modern-day real person. But Fran is a hero. And heroes don't get killed, however much
however much I drop her down a deep pit in the middle of the night, she's not going to get killed. She's only going to be unduly upset. She is an admirable person, and I wish I was her, but I'm not. And she's also totally ruthless. She doesn't care what anyone thinks. She just does it. You know, if it strikes her as a good idea to walk on the wings of a gypsy moth, she does. The only difference between a gypsy moth and a tiger moth is a tiger moth's got brakes. I actually was allowed to fly a tiger moth, but the gypsy moth has got almost no controls. It's got like a fly and a student pilot's license, and I had a little Cessna, and it had a Papua New Guinea, which is nice, and wheels. It had, you know, an artificial horizon, a height thing. It tells you a wind speed indicator and all these, you know, compass, all sorts of useful stuff. A radio. But a gypsy moth has a stick that you pull towards you to go up, push down to go, and it's got, you start it by pouring a mixture of petrol and oil into the thing and blipping the engine until it starts, and you stop it by turning the engine off. It's got a stalling speed of 40 miles an hour, and it looks like it can land on almost anywhere. You can get your little bicycle wheel down. It glides beautifully, yeah. It's a box car, effectively, with a little engine in. But as terrifying things to fly go, it's right there. it's only improvement over a box car, and it has got an engine, but, you know. I spoke to one lady who was Bird, Miss Bird, amazing woman. She wrote a novel, she just died recently. She wrote a novel called, she wrote a book about herself called My God, It's a Woman. I can't remember her first name. I didn't call her a name.